G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 221st. Walter goes to the slammer. My name's Dick Newman, and the news is all a buzz, is it not, this week, my dear listener? I'm sure you've been reading about it. It's about Tiger and Branston and Jones and Klaus, two sets of gay penguins at the Melbourne Sea Life Aquarium. Marvellous stuff. They should be getting an egg, each couple, to hatch, so well done, boys, and good luck with the egg. But we're not here about gay penguins. We're here about history, so let's get on with it.
Dream, 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 dream. Dream, 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 when I want you. In my arms, when I want you. And all your charms, whenever I want you. All I have to do is dream.
But of course, being the other news, where I am in space-time today, Don Everly dead. 84? Can't whinge about that, can you? Okay, hands up, who remembers what we did last week? Nobody? Me either. Must be just talking shit. Now, we said goodbye to Robert Dudley and hello to Robert Devereux, Earl of Essex. Also goodbye to Francis Walsingham on the 6th of February 1590. And I left out a little tale along the way. Let's therefore have a little tale. 8th of February 1587 saw Mary Queen of Scots made dead. About 5 months later, people were complaining about the smell of Fotheringay. Yes, it was a decomposing corpse of Mary. Oh, all right, says Betty. Let's give her a decent funeral. She's no longer scary. Dead Mary will be off to Peterborough Cathedral. 2 a.m. and she will be interred without ceremony ahead of the actual funeral because her coffin was so extremely heavy by reason of the lead that the gentleman could not endure to have carried it with leisure in the solemn proceeding, and besides, it was feared that the lead might rip, and being very hot weather, there might be found some annoyance. Yeah, for annoyance read stink. Okay, that's that little tale. Walsingham had pointed out that his estate would be broke, but we're in the olden days where nothing much is clear. After his death, Cecil will work out that Walsingham was £27,000 in the red, with £12,000 of those pounds owing to Betty. It'll be buggering around with this till 1611, when his brother-in-law has another crack at it and says Betty actually owed Walsingham £48,000. So a judge will decide it was all just quid pro quo and will wipe out all debts on both sides. It's how things go back then. It's rather confusing because you put your hand in your own pocket to pay for government expenses and then you're supposed to claim it back. And just to demonstrate I'm all over the shop, I haven't given you the funeral speech from Mary's funeral, so we'd better have that. It was a low-key event. Betty kept it to just a few English and Scotty nobles with no foreigners, thanks. Betty, of course, didn't go. Let us give God thanks for the happy dissolution of the high and mighty Princess Mary, late Queen of Scotland and Dowager of France, of whose life and death at this time I have not much to say, because I was not acquainted with the one, neither was I present at the other. I will not enter into judgment further, but because it has been signified to me that she trusted to be saved by the blood of Christ, we must hope well for her salvation. For as Father Luther was wont to say, many a one that lived a papist died a Protestant. Off we go to the bishop's palace for the most important bit, the feast. Mary's household staff, who still haven't been let go, will be put in a separate room to boo-hoo-hoo. Mary will stay at Peterborough for 27 years, then we'll dig her up and she's off to Westminster Abbey. We know we'll be finalising the death of Francis Walsingham and hopefully get back on track. We've lost our top spy, so it'll be a frantic search of his papers to see if we can establish his various contacts in England and around Europe. Some of his spies will just contact Cecil saying, hey mate, I want to keep on working. Walsingham's network will survive his death. He'll be praised as a Protestant hero with lots of lovely things written. Of course, if you happen to be Catholic, then you might see Walsingham acting like the vile Lavrenti Beria of the Soviet Union, or some nasty Gestapo type. But no, he wasn't anywhere near that. He was operating at a time when atrocities had been carried out on Dutch Protestants, and we'd had the senseless massacre of the Huguenots at St. Bartholomew's Day. He was getting never-ending reports of plots to assassinate Betty and invade England, with Catholics having cracked troops over there, the Duke of Parma, against our poorly defended England. The Pope was sending not only Catholic priests, but hard-menned Jesuits to disrupt England, using blackmail, torture, state-sanctioned murders, and all those things we hate were in common usage, not only in England, but everywhere else in Europe. And let's face it, those things are in use today by our Western democracies. Hopefully not to a large extent, but they are evident right now today. The US tried bribery on that Iranian oil tanker captain a couple of years ago, and we see the examples of enhanced interrogation and state-sanctioned murders are carried out against Iranian big names quite regularly. Walsingham was a crack administrator and probably a workaholic who worked himself to death. But how's Robert Devereux going? Let's have a look. Robert Devereux will have another crack at getting King Jim VI of Scotland to be his pen pal. His sister Penelope will also write sending a portrait of herself. Fair enough, she's a bit of a cutie, but a guy like Jim VI may have preferred a portrait of Robert Devereux, not Penelope Devereux. Jim doesn't care about their letters, and Betty will give Robert a smack, saying, "Don't interfere with Scotty stuff. I've got guys with brains to do that. Now you just sit there and look pretty." Robert should be writing to his mum, Lettice Knollys, like a good boy. She will write, "Your poor friends here, my dear son, are in great longing to know how you fare, to which purpose we have addressed this bearer to bring us true word thereof. For although our ears are fed with many flying reports, yet we believe nothing but what we receive from the oracle of truth. Wherefore, relieve us, if you please, with some of your occurrence." Lettice by now has married Sir Christopher Blount, 16 years younger than she is. Well done, Lettice. Robert's also about to marry. His pick is the widow of Philip Sidney and daughter of Frances Walsingham, Frances Walsingham. I didn't say that twice. Frances had a daughter named Frances. An I for a boy and an E for a girl in Frances. No permission from Betty, so we'll get Angry Betty. Angry Betty would perhaps have been very angry Betty if she knew that Robert had got Frances up the spout along with a maid of honour, Elizabeth Southwell, also up the spout. Why ever did Devereux marry Frances Walsingham, everyone wants to know. The answer to this, as it is to many things, is money. Now, we've seen that Walsingham, or anybody's estate, working for the government back then is complicated, but even so, Frances had been granted an annuity of £300 a year. That's handy cash. By June, Robert is back in financial difficulty, with Betty calling in a loan. He'll have to sell his manor at Keyston. Poor love. January 1591, and it's a boy for Robert and Frances. Welcome, baby Robert. About now, Henry of Navarre is fighting the Catholic League to cement that silly Frenchy hat on his head. Betty had sent him money and men, but he's in trouble. His general will come to visit Betty, wanting more money and more men. And Betty is not happy if this thing turns into an all-out war with Spanish Phil. On the other hand, she certainly does not want Spanish Phil in control of France and those nearby Frenchy ports. Robert Devereux is looking for action and adventure and to become a mighty hero, so the general will be staying at his house. Robert will find him some cash. Robert will be begging Betty to send him to France for some biff. Robert will buy the governorship of Alderney, one of the Channel Islands, to use it as a base to go to France. Betty, though, is not ready to give Robert command of anything. Sir John Norris will take 3,000 hard men to France. Sir Roger Williams will take another 600. Instead of sulking, Robert will go to Betty and spend 2 hours on his knees begging, "Oh, please, Betty, please, 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 let me go to France, Betty, please." Then he'll write, "I am commanded into France for the establishing of the brave king in quiet possession of Normandy." Yeah, right. Betty is also writing to Henri in France. If, which most I fear, the rashness of his youth does not make him too precipitate, you will never have cause to doubt his boldness in your service, for he has given too frequent proofs that he regards no peril, be what it may, and you are entreated to bear in mind he is too impetuous to be given the reins. But, my God, how can I dream of making any reasonable requests to you, seeing you are so careless of your own life? I must appear a very foolish creature. Only I repeat to you that he will require the bridle rather than the spur. Yeah, keep a rein on this guy. Robert will turn up in France with 4,000 guys. He didn't say goodbye to France as his missus, not even a text. He's there with the job of relieving the siege of Rouen. He will immediately, though, write to Betty. I'll give you just a bit so you know the sort of stuff he writes. I must not let this second day pass without complaining to your majesty of the misery of absence. I shall think my life very unpleasant till I've rid myself of this French action, that I may once again enjoy the honour, the pleasure, the sweetness, which your presence is accompanied with. Yeah, all these letters go on like that. Total sucking up to Betty. I hope your majesty shall presently have great honour by the service of your little troop, and I, as a reward of my service, to be soon at home at your majesty's feet, whence nothing but death or your inconstancy, which is not in rerum natura, can drive me. Yeah, just wants to be at Betty's feet. He's like a little lap puppy, isn't he? Henri was supposed to meet him where he landed, but that didn't happen. Problem is, Robert needs to go through enemy territory to meet up with Henri. Betty had said, don't do that. So Robert will do that, and lose guys on the way. Still, Robert will turn up in utter magnificence to impress Henri, and Betty will be very annoyed. She'll write to Henri, do you really think, mon frère, that these are the ways to treat a prince who allows her subjects to risk their lives to defend your kingdom? Yeah, see, Robert's supposed to be at Rouen, that's Betty's orders, but he's with Henri doing the feasting stuff. And besides, Henri has other plans for Robert. Off they go to Dieppe, and we know what happens to English troops marching through France. Surely we know that by now. Dysentery. Betty wrote to Robert saying, tell King Henri I'm at Portsmouth and he needs to get over here for a please explain. She'll hang around Portsmouth for 5 days, just getting angrier. It will be a sharply worded letter to Robert, but he's got dysentery himself. Worse, of course. He'd sent his young brother to Rouen with 1,200 guys to do that job he's supposed to be doing himself. That young brother scored a fatal bullet. He's dead. Robert will write to Cecil. I was punished with a fever and my heart broken with the Queen's unkindness. Since writing of my last, I lost my brother in an unfortunate skirmish before Rouen. I call it unfortunate that robbed me of him who was dearer to me than ever I was to myself. From Betty's point of view, she sent troops to Rouen and it hasn't really happened, and the meter's ticking, so it's costing more and more. Betty will issue a declaration of the clauses that move Her Majesty to revoke her forces in Normandy. Robert's been recalled, but he's not finished yet. He's hanging out with his new buddy, King Henri. Robert will piss Betty off further by knighting 24 guys. His commission had specifically said no knighting of guys. Betty has reduced all the knighting stuff to a point where she's pretty much it for handing the things out. He will pop back to England for a smack, then Betty will send him back. What are you thinking, Betty? Off he goes to find way less men than he'd left. Dysentery kills. At least he's finally at the job he was sent for, relieve the siege of Rouen. Okay, says Betty, you can come home now. He will come home, but news will be straight in that the Duke of Parma has sent Spanish hard men to help the Catholics at Rouen. Henri will tell Robert that he needs to get his guys out of there. So off they go, heading towards Dieppe. Betty will write, getting up him. Lots of good English have died for absolutely nothing. Stop fucking about and bring the rest home. Meanwhile, in England, Robert's mistress, Elizabeth Southwell, has a baby boy. Betty had no idea that Robert was the dad. He'll get his mate, Thomas Vavasor, to put his hand up, sending Thomas to the slammer instead. Robert will wheedle his way back into Betty's good books when the Chancellor of Oxford gig comes up, but suck it up won't do it for him this time. Francis Bacon is a guy who's had some mentions. Born in 1561, so he's about 30 now. Son of Nicholas Bacon, Keeper of the Great Seal, and Anne Cook, daughter of noted humanist Anthony Cook. Her sister married Cecil, so Cecil is uncle to Francis Bacon. Francis went to Cambridge Uni at 12. He'll live with his elder brother Anthony, with both boys studying under our future Archie Whitgift. Betty will meet the lad and be impressed with his intellect. At 15, Francis will be admitted to Gray's Inn for legal studies. A few months later, and he'll be joining an embassy to Paris under King Henri Anjou. That will teach him a thing or three about politics. He'll be off further to different parts of France as well as Italy and Spain, staying here and there. He'll be looking at the science of the day saying, hey, we're doing it wrong. He'd read Aristotle from a couple of thousand years earlier and say, hey, this guy had it right. He sure did, Francis. 18, and Francis will get word that his dad's dead. Back to England. He didn't get much in the will, so he'll be off to Gray's Inn to earn some cash. He'll try to get into court so he can continue staying, but Cecil won't come through with the gig. At 20, he'll be elected to Parliament. Great to see a young guy getting a go. Francis will like the look of the Puritan stuff and publish his first work criticising the English repression of the Puritan movement. His career at Gray's Inn is going gangbusters, and he's moving up through the ranks at a great pace. That will give him a gig as clerk at the Star Chamber. We need him and his brother now to be Robert Devereux's confidential advisers. I hear you, my dear listener. If Francis Bacon is such a genius, then why the fuck is he working for a prawn like Devereux? Now, Francis and his brother Anthony had returned to England when their dear old dad died. They both went to Uncle Cecil for a job, but he said no. They need to earn, so they've gone to Devereux with the idea that after Walsingham's death, these guys will become MI5. Francis Bacon has already got in touch with Walsingham's codecracker, Thomas Phillips, and Tom has connections with Walsingham's spies. Devereux is also jealous of Cecil and his son Robert Cecil because Betty spends time with them. Cecil had taken back Walsingham's job, so Robert Devereux thinks he can knock them back a peg or two by being better at the spy stuff. Oddly enough, around now, Devereux will become matey with Walter Raleigh. They both think oppression of the Puritans is a bit harsh. They'll team up to save Puritan John Oodle from the chop, but he'll just die in the slammer anyway. Walsingham died and there was competition among the guys to be his successor. Devereux had put up his man, but Cecil pointed out that the guy Devereux put up was one of the movers in the killing of Jim Six's mum, Mary Queen of Scots. Putting him in the job may piss off our very compliant Scotty King. Betty then did not fill the job, but gave Cecil a nod by employing his son Robert Cecil to be Cecil's assistant. That frees up time for Cecil to take it on, but he's got no budget. I think we might want to check in on our police state, have a look and see if we approve or not. Always your decision, my dear listener. That look around Europe will help. France, Italy and Spain are all Catholic states that are into persecuting Protestants. Protestants, of course, are happy to belt back. England is Protestant and facing intervention by those three Catholic states. The Holy Roman Empire, or Germanic states, is the odd one out. Phil's brother Ferdinand had smartly decided that religion could be determined by the individual states. Luther had helped out in that bigly by putting in the religious rule that you must obey your civic leader. So for Ferdinand, it was who cares who does what magic show, so long as you unite with me to fight the Ottoman Empire to stop us from all having to be Muslims. For England then, it was defend the Queen and the government from Catholic incursions, which were mainly subversive elements, secret guys. There's a ton of evidence to demonstrate that England was not into full-on persecution of Catholics. If people do the Catholic magic stuff quietly or privately, or declare that they're Catholics, who cares? Not Betty. It's the covert Catholics looking to disrupt the government that are a problem. Ordinary Protestant types would no doubt have also been anti-Catholic because a Catholic takeover might mean civil war and a return to the bonfires. The circumstances are perfect for Walsingham to create a police state and have a spy network. Of course, this brings problems that we don't like. I gave you a story about Dudley stitching up a couple of guys, and while we've got no evidence, because Dudley didn't want evidence, it seems plain as day that Dudley used the system to have a couple of guys killed so he could get their land. What I didn't give you, and perhaps I should have, was any of the other stories of stitch-ups. Evidence exists on these. It goes like this. You've got a network of spies, let's say undercover FBI agents. Let's say these guys are professionals. You also have a nice fat budget for informants. These are not professionals, but may have connections and can gather information that you may otherwise find hard to get. Informers are paid on a case-by-case basis. They're not on the payroll. Our informer wants cash. He goes to a guy who's got some Catholic sympathy. He then gets to be mates with him and over time starts revealing a plot for a Catholic takeover of England. Now this plot only exists in the informer's mind. He talks up the plot so it looks foolproof, but he just needs one or two more guys. Do you have any friends you could totally trust to help out? I only need you and, say, two more to hold the horses, that's all. Our Catholic sympathiser and his mates are in and that's it. They're nabbed for being involved in a plot that is actually non-existent. Now, we've got records to show that sort of stuff was going on under Walsingham. Worse, of course. What if Walsingham didn't come up with a plot for, well, let's say 6 months? Betty may lose interest in a secret service and, worse, she may not want to fund it. Walsingham then needs to come up with a steady stream of plots so Betty knows he's working hard to keep her safe and alive. Worse is the whole state-sanctioned murder of Mary Queen of Scots devised by Walsingham. Perhaps Betty got angry after that execution because she realised that she'd been fooled. Get on my knees and pray. Thanks for praying for us, Roger, but we do get fooled over and over again. In Australia, we made our first move towards a police state somewhere after 9/11 when the government passed legislation that it could observe our metadata. That is, our individual metadata. That one always sticks in my mind because at the time the Attorney General was interviewed about it, and after telling us how safe it would make us all, he was asked to define metadata. It turned out this dickhead had no idea what metadata was. He's just passed fucking legislation about it, but he didn't know what it was. The Australian Spook Department had just talked the government into police state legislation. Yeah, we need this to keep everybody safe. Metadata, if you don't know what it means, and that's okay, you're not the Attorney General passing legislation on it, but it means they can see who I send emails to and what the subject lines is. Or they can see what websites I visit, like scone porn, where there are images of young juicy strawberries ripe to be made into jam and hot young juicy cows having their girly bits massaged until the cream comes streaming out. Well, I think I ought to start that website now. Point is that at the time I was whinging about this to me mate who gave me that classic response, if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. I was actually a bit surprised with this guy, given his family background. His mum and dad, German Jews, had got out of Germany in the early 40s. His grandparents stuck around saying, hey, it can't get any worse. It certainly got worse for them. They ended up in a state-based industrial murder unit and did not survive. Now, Hitler didn't just wake up one morning and say, hey, let's mass murder humans I don't like. It started out with small-scale stuff. Bits of legislation as the foundation, and then he just built on it and built on it until we got to the murder machines. The US, of course, has plenty of entrapment cases. Narsil Batiste, guru of the Moorish Science Temple of America, which had four elements: Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and of course, martial arts. Yeah, great combo. An FBI informant will go to the FBI telling him that the group had asked him to put them in touch with Al-Qaeda. They hadn't, but the informer has scored a job with the FBI. This informer and one of his mates will tell the group that they're good buddies with Osama bin Laden. Now, Guru Batiste, he's starting to think that he could get money out of these two dickheads. He was broke, of course. They will keep talking up more and more money they can give him, while in return he'll make more and more compromising statements to get that cash. At some point, the informers will say, "Give us a list of what you need to carry out an attack on Chicago." This guy will make up a nonsense list. There's a video of this exchange, and Batiste knows less about materials for a terrorist attack than I do. Still, he will promise to blow up buildings and shoot survivors. Just give me the cash. He's promising a terror attack that he has no intent of doing, while they're promising cash that they have no intent of giving. Not even the FBI believe Batiste. Justice Department will get them for swearing allegiance to a terrorist organisation and taking photos of government buildings. And we're all safe once more. Batiste and six of his mates will cop a total of 43 years in the slammer for a nonsense thing. It took three trials for the Justice Department to get a conviction. Official FBI position was that this was a bad deal and we should think hard about doing something like that ever again. Field officers, though, seem to have not got that memo. They're just doing more and more of this stuff. The world is just the same. Keith Moon was earning his pay that day, wasn't he? Now, Walter Raleigh had been keen to send ships to his new colony in America. That all got canned when we saw that Armada would be coming and needed every ship to defend England. 1590, and he well managed to get two ships allowed out, but their main brief is privateering. They won't be taking any more colonialists, but we'll take that painter guy, White, grandfather to the first English person born in America, Baby Virginia Dare. Off they go to Roanoke, and there's nobody. No sign of life at all. Nobody knows what happened to Baby Virginia or the other colonials, never ever seen ever again. While that was going on, Raleigh was in Ireland, County Cork. Youghal. Oh, that's my terrible English. Youghal, I think, is how you say it. Youghal. He needs to fulfil the terms of his land grant and get colonialists into the place. As do all the other English with land grants in Ireland. Undertakers, if you remember, that's what we call them, undertakers. The government is talking about taking back lands if we don't get settlers in. Raleigh has the biggest job because he's got the biggest amount of land. Garrett Fitzgerald and Eleanor Butler's estates, the Desmond lands. He's also about the best bloke for the job. He knows Ireland, he knows how to get on with people. Then he wants to secure the place against foreign invasion and get an economy going, so she doesn't have to keep putting cash into the place. Raleigh will do well with the local economy and in getting in of English to take over the place. He's brought in people with commonality, from Devon and Cornwall, and mainly Catholic. He's expecting they'll bring in more Catholics. He's promoting production of commodities like glass, iron and timber. Yeah, that last one's going to be a bit tricky because we're going to ban timber sales to Spain. He's expanded the fisheries and really expanded trading partners. Youghal had been dealing with Bristol and some Spanish traders. Now Raleigh has markets going in Amsterdam, London, Yorkshire, Spain, and even the Canary Islands. was going very well. Raleigh also knew the land pretty well from his Irish campaign. On that basis, he'd gotten Betty Leese in strategic lands as well, of course, as lots of lands. To tidy stuff up, he'll lease bits from the church and buy other bits from the English so he can fully control strategic rivers on both sides. That will allow easy movement of goods and easy ability to collect taxes. No potential enemies on the way because Raleigh owns or leases it. It's not impregnable, but there's tricky terrain for anybody wanting to attack his patch. Tricky won't stop everyone, so we'll have raids, but his patch is more easily defended. The point of security on your home, my dear listener, is not to keep burglars out, because that's pretty much impossible. It's to make your neighbour's house look more attractive to a burglar. That's what Walter's doing. Raleigh will also be into agricultural experimentation and it's the potato. Now, Spaniards had brought in a type of potato from South America, but we weren't really into it. Raleigh has got his hands on the North American strain, and we like it. Very versatile. You can boil it and mash it with cream and butter, roast it in oil, cut it up and deep fry it into chips or French fries, or if you're American, freedom fries. Yeah, very nationalistic there, guys. It was most likely our brainiac Harriet who brought it back from America. His brief there had been to investigate crops in America. Irish will really like this crop. It's like our turnips have been for England, a crop that will survive and keep you alive. Armies can't just set fire to a crop of potatoes. It'll grow in poor soil and needs lots of rain, like what you get in Ireland. Raleigh also experimented with fruit trees and may be the guy who introduced the cherry tree to Ireland. Yule is becoming cosmopolitan with a decent economy, and with all that stuff, you get tolerance. A Portuguese Jew will be elected mayor. Can you believe it? My schoolboy history has Raleigh as the discoverer of the mighty spud, the potato, as well as tobacco to get us all on the fags. No. Both the spud and the fags were first brought to Europe by the Spaniards. We had them before Raleigh did doodly squat. The North American spud we eat today was brought in by the English, but not Raleigh. Now, Raleigh did enjoy getting on the booze and fags with his brainiac mate Harriet, and it seems likely, again, that it was Harriet who brought home a pile of tobacco leaves. Raleigh is a great guy, so later historians probably wanted to give him a few extra points. Raleigh also has his mate, the poet Spenser, who wrote The Fairy Queen close by. Spenser can chat with him about court intrigue and the arts, while Harriet can chat about science. Oh, it all sounds very heavenly, does it not? That science chat is about to become dangerous. It's a heretical attempt to deny the true knowledge as set out in the big book of magic. Worse, it could be black magic brought to us by none other than the devil. Oh dear. Harriet will soon be accused of being an atheist. Oh dear, oh dear. John Dee will find his library burned. So, perhaps it's not all happy chats over booze and fags. And right now, Harriet is pretty safe in Cosmopolitan Island, where people are too happy to be upset by magical bullshit. It's become a place to escape religious persecutions in England. In England, we're back to worrying about war with Spain. Raleigh will be put in charge with securing Ireland, and the best way to do that is to get those English colonisers in. He's very busy, but will find a minute or two to bang a door of one of the settlers. There will be a kitty, but Walter's too busy for it. Happy to say, though, he will appoint a sheriff with the job description being Stop Persecuting the Irish. He's up for working with the English settlers, the English Irish, and the Irish Irish, or, let's face it, he's happy to work with anybody. He's setting the foundations for a successful integration of Ireland. Just a shame that some of these guys he's helping out are ripping him off as humans do. And again, I know what you're saying, my dear listener. Of course I don't really. Best guess is this. If Wally is doing so well in Ireland, why didn't they live happily ever after? The answer being that Walter is not the only big swinging dick in Ireland, and there are guys with bigger dicks making them bigger dickheads. The sheriff that Walter appointed didn't get straight into the job. The council said, no way, we like current hard man Myag, who will stick around for another year, saying that Walter's guy that he wants is a traitor for not being cunty to the Irish. Myag just loves a good hanging of Irish people. We are also well and truly still in that situation where the English just ignore Betty's directives to win the hearts and minds. That's what Betty wants. She wants it all to settle down, but no, the English authorities in Ireland say, no, Betty doesn't know what she's talking about. It's tracking guys down and killing them or tossing them into nasty slammers, and that's been 3 years after the end of the Desmond Rebellion. It's just going on and on. Ex-Sheriff Myag will go to England to ask for permission to retire. Great. Not. They will refuse retirement and make him a justice in Ireland instead. What's needed is a gentle hand, but Myag doesn't have one. It'll get the stage where even the hard-assed Irish council will eventually have enough of him. He'll be attainted and his toys taken away. He can be detained indefinitely. Still, I think we can all admire Walter Raleigh just a little bit more. Walter is doing well on his patch, so it's time for him to meet the Countess of Desmond. Now, you're expecting Eleanor Butler, are you not? No, this will not be Eleanor Butler. This will be the other Countess of Desmond, Catherine Fitzgerald. Now, Eleanor's man Garrett was the 14th Earl, while this chook was married to the 11th Earl. Garrett's dad was the 13th Earl. He'd taken over from his uncle, with his uncle, the 12th Earl, taking over from his granddad, Catherine's husband. You are smelling a smelly old rat, are you not? Fair enough. But Walter's not. Catherine Fitzgerald kind of appears in history. Listed as born in 1504, maybe, and died 1604. Maybe. Walter Raleigh will later write about her, saying she married during the reign of Ted IV. Yeah, way back then, which would make her 135 when she died. Other writings have her at 150 when she died. She was said to have danced at Dick III's wedding 117 years before she met Raleigh. Nice for Catherine at the time she met Walter was that she'd grown a brand new set of teeth. There will be lots of writings about her, all by English authors, but the only one to actually meet her will be Raleigh. By the 18th century, we'll have her living 162 years. Check your broom cupboard, my dear listener. She might be alive and living in it. Fast forward to 1881 for a minute, and we'll find Mary Agnes Hickson, prolific writer of Irish history. Mary had been well and truly over English propaganda at that time about the filthy Irish Catholics harming our poor dear Protestants. She decided that people should know stuff about the English massacres of the Irish Catholics in the past. She was trying to point out that shitfuckery happens on all sides, not just one side. And hey, she says, it's not just Ireland. Shitfuckery happens all over Europe. That will not help her to be mispopular at all. We don't like that. We're supposed to be the good guys. She is the one who will do the research and really emphasise that the only person who ever said that they actually met Catherine Fitzgerald was Walter Raleigh. Other officials in Ireland at this time may have mentioned her in their writings, but none had met her. There's no record of a death or a funeral for Catherine Fitzgerald. Here's Raleigh's writing. I myself knew the old Countess of Desmond of Inchiquin in Munster, who lived there in the year 1589 and many years since, who was married in Edward IV's time and held her jointure from all the Earls of Desmond since then, and that this is true all of the noblemen and gentlemen of Munster can witness. In this case, either Walter met some old chook, or he's making this shit up. But his writings give us the crux of the matter, the jointure. And of course it does give us a bit more when he talks about nobles and gentlemen who can witness, meaning there's lots of people in Ireland who are older than 100. The story then is that Tom Fitzgerald gave Catherine Fitzgerald a tenancy for life over Inchiquin Castle. 1575, and for some reason she passed it on to Garrett, who then did that deal to hand everything to Eleanor and his son. Except there's no evidence that Tom Fitzgerald ever married a Catherine. No writings back at that time about someone as important as the Countess of Desmond. There's no records in England about a Catherine Fitzgerald, even though Irish nobles often visited the English court. Twins for that little bit of music there. Now, all this looks like a plot by the Irish to keep Inchiquin in their hands. Maybe a plot, maybe not. It may be something else. We don't know. But dower rights will trump attained a forfeiture. So Raleigh will look over documents and say, okay, I get it. You have the place for life. The old chook has been successful in her fraud and will maybe live in the castle. Maybe live in the castle. We don't even know if she exists. But somebody's going to get the rents from the place for the rest of her life. Which is when, you ask. Well, Raleigh will end up selling a lot of his Irish lands to a guy, Richard Boyle. When this Richard Boyle goes to look for Catherine Fitzgerald, there won't be anyone there. A big bunch of Irish have been renting the land at mates rates. Not only that, the tenants had mysterious leases that predated Raleigh, which said they could take as much timber from the forest as they liked. Those cheap rents were actually optional on some leases. Pay if you like, don't if you don't. Others had a pittance for rent. Eightpence, stuff like that. And there you go. Even when you get a very rare decent digger like Walter Raleigh looking to bring prosperity and harmony, you'll find people wanting to rip him off. Let you and I be kind to Walter, though. And he can fall in love. But first I might point out that the whole hate triangle of Raleigh, Walter Devereux and Robert Cecil might be a bit exaggerated. Betty's top advisor is, of course, Robert Cecil's dad, but he's getting old, and each of the three lads would like to take over that position. But all three are pretty different. Robert Devereux is a young hothead who wants to go off to war so he can be glorious. Apart from that, he's into the sorts of stuff that nobles are into. Hunting, jousting, feasting, gambling, wenching, that type of stuff. Walter Raleigh has no plans to go off and be a mighty hero. He's into colonising and mercantile stuff. He hasn't got time for hunting. He wants to get the economies going. Raleigh and Devereux also would have done business together, with Raleigh having the monopoly on wine licences and Devereux having the monopoly on sweet wine imports. These monopolies need to work together. They will also work together on the military. Raleigh is captain of the guard, with Devereux master of the horse. For a big contrast, Robert Cecil won't be doing anything military because of his scoliosis. Now, this guy might have been under 5 foot tall. He won't be doing any noble pursuits, won't be doing any mercantile stuff. He's stuck at court, working in the government bubble, we might say these days. As for being Betty's best boy, Raleigh and Devereux have other differences. Raleigh is pretty intelligent and he has government experience both in administration and policy. Essex doesn't give a fuck about administration and policy, but he has the noble stuff to make him useful in foreign affairs. Robert Cecil has been trained by his dad to be a master of administration. He could take over tomorrow if given the chance. Okay, let's get our love story underway and meet Bess Throckmorton, daughter of Ambassador Nicholas Throckmorton. Bess was Betty's lady. July 1591, Bess is up the spout. November 1591, top secret wedding. March 1592, top secret christening, with Robert Devereux being godfather. So that's a pretty good indication that Devereux and Raleigh were getting along. Betty knows nothing. Robert Cecil will ask Raleigh, and Raleigh will deny it. Obvious then that Raleigh trusts Devereux, but not Cecil. Bess has been on leave from court, but will return. Baby will die. There's never a good time to tell Betty about a secret marriage, but Betty, of course, will find out. June and Bess and Walter will be under house arrest. Different houses, of course. That won't stop Betty from giving Walter Sherborne Castle, making him the big dick squire in Devon. On that basis, it looks like Walter and Bess were under house arrest for doing the dirty deed, but Betty may not yet know about the marriage. July, and it looks like Betty does know, so it's off to the tower for Walter and Bess. Lady listeners should not be shocked by now to know that it was all Bess's fault. Yes, her fault. She married without permission, and she humiliated the Queen by keeping secret her affair, pregnancy, and marriage. She had stolen the Queen's much-loved rally. Bess is now in Lettice Nolly's territory, out for life. Walter had spent 12 years writing love poetry to Betty and telling her she was a goddess. Betty would most likely have been okay with Walter doing stuff like banging a serving wench or three, so long as he didn't fall in love with them. By marrying Bess, Walter has crossed the line and he's acted as a coward by not telling her. Raleigh can spend time in the tower and, Robert Devereux didn't have to go to the slammer for his naughty marriage to Frances Walsingham. Raleigh can spend time writing poetry. Not his best stuff, he's a bit whingy, and how he's so sad that Betty doesn't love him anymore. You might think that Walter should be writing about his dear Mrs. Bess Throckmorton, but let's face it, Bess is a mortal and Betty is a goddess. Betty is surviving on courtly love, the love that can never be. Oh. His poetry isn't working. If Betty is a goddess, then that should have been enough for Walter. Why ever would he need anyone else? The writings will be bitter. Like other goddesses, Betty is perfection, but also like other goddesses, she's got just one fault, cruelty. Betty can't forgive him for this one teeny tiny mistake, and Walter can't forgive her inability to forgive him. Betty should not have thought that just because he got married that he loved her any less. She has wronged him, plunging him into despair. Now we're getting somewhere. Pain can lead to art, so his poetry will pick back up. He will write the poem of his life, one last shot at getting Betty back. It compares courtly life to life in the summer. The last thing he expected from Betty was that she would stop loving him. He's now got it. The bond between them is irrevocably broken. The 12-year courtship has ended. Unless Betty wants to kiss and make up. Now this one is considered to be one of the best poems of the time. Yeah, and Raleigh will give it to Robert Cecil to pass on to Betty. The next person, though, to actually read it will do so in 1860. Poetry hasn't done the trick for Walter Raleigh. He needs something to fall out of the sky to get him out of the slammer. And something will fall out of the sky. Not just yet. He's going to have to wait. Betty, in the meantime, is looking at a piggy bank and there's not much in it. She's spent up supporting the lowlands, defend against Spanish Field and supporting the Huguenots in France. Then there was the cost to defend England against the Armada. What to do? She could desert the European Protestants and let the Navy relapse into a state of weakness, or call Parliament to raise taxes. Trouble with that last one is that Betty knows what Parliament will want back. They will want an end to the monarchy, handing out nice stuff to the monarch's best boys. Things like monopolies or the right to purveyance. That's the one where people have to sell stuff cheap if it's the government buying. We, of course, are with Parliament on this one. Both monopolies and purveyance are bad things. No good to the economy, no good to the population, very good for individuals to become stinking rich, and lovely things for a king to hand out to keep his mates very loyal. Betty doesn't want to give them up, so she will come up with a cunning plan. Look at the economy and get it in hand. Increase productivity in collection of customs and taxes, reform abuses like fraud and embezzlement, and cut down the huge margins charged by collectors of government income. That last one is the easiest, so let's go there first. Betty had copped a break in this matter when a whistleblower had managed to get in to see her to let her know what was going on. This guy was just a clerk or a low ranker in the government, so guys like Dudley, Cecil and Walsingham said, "Oh, you can't listen to this guy. He's just common and smelly. You can't take advice from a clerk complaining about his betters." Betty, though, can listen to him and will take his advice and put up the price for a collector of customs from £12,000 a year to £42,000 a year. She'll also get Cecil onto looking for more cash to be found. That will see a bill put to Parliament for accountants to pay their arrears on estate taxes. Parliament will say, "Okay, how about we pay what's due now? But surely you can't expect people to pay for what's owing in the past." The Lord Treasurer will say, "My Lords, if you had lost your purse, by the way, would you look back or forwards to find it? The Queen has lost her purse." I love that. I've got no problems with taxing the rich, no problems at all. But our modern governments continue to give tax breaks to the rich because trickle-down economics will work one day. Same day that baby Jesus returns, I think. This stuff again gives Betty a boost in the opinion polls. Common smellies love it that she doesn't hit them up for cash. Now, the only thing that Betty spends up big on is her appearance. All those magnificent frocks and jewels and wigs. She looks like a big spender, but she is tight as a fish's ass when it comes to spending on pretty much anything else. Common smellies may love it a bit, but people who are close to her might not be quite so fond of her. Her progresses can cost people an arm and a leg. Courtiers know there's no point at all in asking her for anything unless they've got a nice gift for her first. Even if they want something that we might see as totally just, it's pony up first, mate. In all this, she will, of course, be totally charming to them. As an example of the progress thingy, Betty will want to visit Ted Seymour, Earl of Hertford, at his place at Elverham. Good news for him is that he's stinking rich. Bad news is that Elverham's pretty much a hunting lodge. He'll knock up some accommodation using timber, fit them out and furnish them. For the royal visit, he will also have his guys dig a very large pond with three islands in it. One of the islands is to have a fort, and a ship will be built to sail around it. Then he brings in the artists to be sea gods to battle with the holders of the castle and the sailors on the ship. Now that must have cost him an absolute bundle. Another of Betty's favourites, Christopher Hatton, can die. 51, no idea what killed him. The report has it that he died of a broken heart because Betty demanded some cash he owed her at the time when his cash flow was bad. Betty will be off to see him to say, "Hey, mate, don't take this payment stuff to heart." But too late, he'll die. His heir will be his nephew who married Cecil's granddaughter, and Betty will forgive them the debt. Christopher had done very well in the getting of stuff from Betty. She's doing that stuff like not filling bishoprics for a year, so she can get that income as well. Then, of course, she wants the first fruits when it does get filled. On top of that, the bishops may find their lands reduced further, as happened with the Bishop of Ely, who had to give Christopher Hatton the garden and orchards of Ely House. Bishop says no. Betty writes, "Proud prelate, I understand you are backward in complying with your agreement, but I would have you to know that I who made you what you are can unmake you, and if you do not forthwith fulfil your engagement, my God, I will immediately unfrock you. Yours as you demean yourself, Elizabeth." Francis Bacon will write about an encounter she had with a guy. She asks, "What does a man think of when he thinks of nothing?" Bad question, lady listeners. Don't ask your man what they're thinking of when they're thinking of nothing. They're thinking of fucking nothing. Now, this guy was waiting on Betty to deliver some grass soon, so he'll say, "Madam, he thinks of a woman's promise." She'll say, "Well, I must not refute you. Anger makes dull men witty, but it keeps them poor." Tesla proved that Betty delaying her giving stuff, saying if you do it nice and fast, then they'll be back for more all the sooner. Oh, and it seems like we're back in France. Now, over in France, Henri of Navarre will be struggling. His Swiss and German mercenaries were just about to desert from lack of pay when Betty will chip in with £22,000. That might seem extreme, but he is keeping Spanish Phil and the Duke of Parma nicely busy for us. She will also send Peregrine Bertie, Baron Willoughby, and 4,000 hard men to help get Henri take Paris back. That then will have Spanish Phil sending hard men to the north of France, just across the channel from us. So Sir John Norris and 3,000 guys will be sent to help Henri of Navarre there. Now, Eleanor Butler, oh, we've finished with France already. Eleanor Butler, our Countess of Desmond, had kept a low profile during the Armada business. Smart move, given that Garrett's name was linked with Spaniards turning up in Ireland. Once the dust settled, Betty found time to see her. Eleanor can give her the whole story, ending up with saying, look, thanks for granting me a pension of £100, but your guys in Ireland refuse to give me a cracker. Betty will write to the Lord Deputy in Ireland to give Eleanor £200 a year. Yeah, thanks, Betty, says Eleanor. That doesn't mean I will actually get it. Oh, sure, kiddo, says Betty. I've got it. Betty will personally write that letter and sign it, saying, make this payment promptly. I don't want Eleanor to have to complain to me. That letter is still on record. It has a note on it made by the Irish guys. Pension will not be paid upon a doubt made by Mr. Solicitor. Fuckers. Eleanor has returned to Ireland thinking she'll at least have some cash. Still on the happy side, Sir John Perrott has been recalled, and we'll get to that tale. On the unhappy side, Sir William Fitzwilliam is the new boss, same as the old boss. Well, not quite. But it's still shit fuckery, just in a different area. A couple of months and the council will give her a bit of a pension. Eleanor will write to England, saying, can my pension be paid from England and not Ireland? Betty will say sure, and Eleanor will get enough cash to buy herself and her daughter's new frocks and move from Ireland to Westminster in London. There's good reasons for her to move to England. Betty is into the survey of Irish lands with the Desmond estates being split up. Eleanor has zero chance of getting anything out of that Irish council, so she wants to try her luck in England. Also, her sickly son is in the tower and he's not getting any better. So Eleanor wants to be able to visit regularly and get doctors in. Eleanor can now meet a man, Donogh O'Connor Sligo. He's into petition for the return of his title and estate. He'd inherited from his uncle who died and the Irish government decided to take the land. So Eleanor and Donogh have got something in common. The O'Connor Sligo family also goes back to the Normans way back, and they had been big swinging dicks at one point since then. But as happens, the O'Donnells grew a bigger dick and the O'Connors became subservient to them. O'Connors looked to England for help, but he said OK, but in comes Sir Richard Bingham as President of the province. He decided to carry out his brief of ditching Irish law to English law in an extremely prompt and hard manner. Now this fucking transition period for Bingham. He wanted to show he was a hard man, so kicked off by seizing an O'Connor Sligo castle, saying it's needed against the invasion of Mary Queen of Scots supporters. Yeah, right. Our man Dio's uncle will appeal to Sir John Perrott. He'll confirm support for all of the uncle's stuff except that castle and lands that Bingham has taken. The uncle will die and Dio will be happy that he'll be inheriting. Bingham will say, nah, Dio's not the legitimate heir, therefore all lands will go to Betty. A commission will be held that confirms that Dio is the legitimate heir. Does Bingham give a fuck? Not a chance. He's moved his brother in. While this was going on, Armada ships were being washed up on the Irish coast. English in Ireland will treat this as an invasion. Oh my God, shipwrecked sailors, it's an invasion. So we surely can't give Donogh his stuff. Dono, therefore, is off to England and will meet Eleanor Butler. They're both pretty broke, so we'll have to be extremely patient. Only those who can pay will get to the top of the list of things to look into. Patience will pay off. Cecil's son, Robert Cecil, will be sympathetic, and that makes their prospects, let's say, less gloomy. Now, back in Ireland, another guy, Hugh O'Neill, is looking at Bingham's shit fuckery with Dono's stuff. He's a good, loyal earl. Now he's seen Bingham belting up the O'Rourkes, who had sheltered some shipwrecked Spaniards. And there goes Bingham belting up the Maguires, and hey, they're O'Neill's guys. Now this is starting to look like a repeat of what happened to Garrett Fitzgerald. O'Neill might be rethinking his loyalty. This is not a good time, though, for him to leap into action, so he'll take his case to the Irish Council and tell them how totally loyal he is. But then in 1591, he'll spring his relative, Red Hugh O'Donnell, out of the slumber and start talking up rebellion with the chieftains, but say, look, hold that thought until the time is right. And once again, we see that invading another country is not as easy as it looks. Friends list there, but no historical fiction. I'm halfway through A Boy's Own Adventure, and I can put up with heroic heroes who do nothing but good, and villainous villains who are just evil, but this guy's also put in all those mayhap type words, and I'm a bit over it. But just before I go, see, there's lots of news about Afghanistan at the moment, is there not? And it's all shock and surprise. I don't know why they're shocked and surprised. Withdrawing from a war is always messy. But the stuff I'm more interested in is about the money, of course. So I see it's come out that somewhere around 80 to 90% of funds spent, those trillions of dollars that the Americans say the wars cost them, were actually spent in America, not in Afghanistan or anything like that. It's spent on defence contractors and aid groups and whatever. And so it stays in the US economy. Now, the idea is that they were supposed to win the war, which they failed, and then you say to Afghanistan, well, you owe us all those trillions of dollars it cost us to fight the war, so we'll just take it out of the precious stuff you got under the ground. But even on that basis, it means that the trillions of dollars spent have to be stumped up sometime by taxpayers. And then if they do get the precious stuff out of the Afghanistan ground, that just goes to corporations too. And by the way, these aid groups don't think that they're actually providing aid. They're just covert military things, most of them. Point is, lots of Americans got very wealthy out of this little war. Then you see things like they spent $43 million on a gas station. Now, this is like a petrol station, only it pours out gas for gas powered cars, not petrol. The thing's just like an ordinary service station, but it cost $43 million. Now somebody made a fucking shit ton out of that. But my favourite story in all this is the payment of non-existent Afghani soldiers. We found this at the collapse of the Western Roman Empire way back 1700 years ago, where guys out in the provinces would be saying to Rome, look, I've got 2,000 soldiers here, so I need to pay them. So Rome would send the cash, and the guy would just keep it because he might only have 400 or 500 soldiers. Then, when the enemy comes in, you find you're fucked because you think there's 2,000 guys there to defend the place, and they just don't exist. So the US were apparently spending about $300 million a year on soldiers that just didn't exist, and guys were pocketing it. To make it worse, of course, the Afghani soldiers who were there weren't getting paid, and if they did get paid, their pay rate was about a seventh of what the Taliban were paying their soldiers. That gets us to the US announcing the withdrawal, and the politicians would have been told there'll be plenty of time because we've got 300,000 Afghani soldiers there to stop the Taliban getting to Kabul too quickly. That'll give us plenty of time to evacuate. Well, those 300,000 soldiers they thought to defend against about, say, 25,000 Taliban turned out to be 50,000 soldiers to defend against 25,000 Taliban. And of the 50,000, they were underpaid or not paid at all. So when the Taliban turned up, they said, "Oh, fuck it, have the place, we don't care." And on that happy little note, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And I think this week I'm going to have a go at a bit of Joss Stone. Played Anna Cleves, didn't she, in The Tudors, Joss Stone. So we go out with her having a crack at Janis Joplin's song, "Piece of My Heart." Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Everything that a woman possibly can.